My name is Victor Furman. Some call me The Voice. I've always been fascinated with human nature, spirituality, science, and the crossroads at which they meet. Join me now and we will explore these topics and so much more with fascinating guests, authors, and experts who will guide us to Destination Unlimited. In the early 1960s, one of the popular television shows was Ben Casey. Set in a hospital, the show would begin with actor Sam Jaffe's character, Dr. Zorba, drawing traditional symbols on a blackboard and calling out their names. Man, woman, birth, death, infinity. In the West, when most of us are born, we're welcomed into this world with warmth, love, and happiness. When it comes time for us to leave this world, we're most often surrounded with sadness, tears, and fear. Is there a way we can make the experience of death like an experience of birth? What lessons may we learn from transition that will change our perspective on death? Who may we turn to for the same loving care, comfort, and security that we received entering this world as we do leaving it? My guest this week on Destination Unlimited, Dr. Deborah Diamond, went from a high-powered and successful Wall Street money manager to death doula through a series of remarkable experiences. Following a high-profile career as a Wall Street money manager, Deborah began her journey to a life of purpose and spirituality. She loves to assist people through spirit and provide assistance, comfort, and guidance through readings, consultations, her books, and speaking engagements. She's a natural psychic medium and medical intuitive who was gifted with her abilities as a child. She provides remarkable insights for her clients to assist in healing, expansion, and transition. Deborah is the author of Life After Near Death, Miraculous Stories of Healing and Transformation in the Extraordinary Life of People with Newfound Powers. She's been featured in the Washington Post, the San Francisco Chronicle, the Wall Street Journal, Forbes, Inc., the Huffington Post, and NPR. Prior to her shift towards spirituality, Deborah was a regular commentator on CNBC and a professor at Johns Hopkins University. Her website is DeborahDiamondPsychic.com. That's Deborah, D-E-B-R-A, DiamondPsychic.com. And she joins me this week to discuss her experiences and new book, Diary of a Death Doula, 25 Lessons the Dying Teach Us About the Afterlife. Please join me in welcoming to Destination Unlimited, Deborah Diamond. Good evening, Deborah.
Good evening, Victor. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
And thank you so much for joining us. You have a remarkable story. When one hears that you were a number one ranked money manager for many years, president of a best performing investment fund on Wall Street, first woman hedge fund manager, founder of 7 investment partnerships, and recruited by George Soros to join his team of managers, one would not think that psychic and medium would be part of your CV. But let's start with your early years. How did these gifts manifest for you in childhood?
That's a great question, Victor. And, you know, for me, it was very natural. You know, as a kid, I knew things, and I feel like I was communicating with an invisible world. But you know, what I have to say is that all kids are open. And it's only in our culture that they become closed off, because in many instances when they remark to their parents that they see something or hear something unusual, you know, their parents warn them never to mention that again, and they shut down their abilities. I read for many people, and I often hear these stories from them saying, you know, I used to be so open as a kid, and then I lost it, and now it's coming back. Well, you know, they lose it because they're told that this is not acceptable, you know, and their parents are afraid. So in my case, I was open, but it really didn't begin to manifest and become evident until I was later in the investment business. I have an MBA in finance, and following getting my MBA, I went into the investment business, and that was when I started to see things, a little more, starting to put the pieces together, although it still wasn't, I still didn't know that that's what it was. Let me just explain. When I was in the investment business, I always knew things. So what did I know? We used to get a big stack of mail delivered to us three times a day, and that would include annual reports, prospectuses, and research reports. And we were expected to read all of them and, learn about these potential investments. In my case, I would be able to pick up a prospectus and know about the company, know about the product, the industry, the management team, if it would be a good investment or not, and without reading it. I didn't know how I knew these things. There was nobody there to talk to about this. I just kind of took it. I just understood that I knew things, and that's as far as it went. I didn't have time to philosophize or try to figure it out. I was juggling about 20 balls in the air, three kids, marriage, and my clients were in the UK and Switzerland, so I was jetting back and forth. And I was very busy, so I just understood that I knew these things, and that's as far as it went. My boss used to say to me, Deborah, you have really good instincts. And I thought, okay, instincts, good instincts, that must be the answer. So that was, all I thought it was. And of course, in the investment business, the term psychic doesn't come up. This is not part of the vocabulary, so it was never mentioned. It wasn't until later that in 2007 when I decided to take an intuition development class in New York, because I thought, I have pretty good intuition, it would be fun to tune it up, that these gifts came out in full force. But they were there, they were somewhat latent and, but somewhat active, but they became much more activated after that.
Let's go back to your childhood for a second, because I think what you mentioned is very important. I know when I was a kid and I started verbalizing the things that I was seeing and experiencing, I was told I had an overactive imagination until an event took place in which it was established that I didn't have an overactive imagination. And that's my story for another time. Were other members of your family gifted or open to subtle energy?
Yes, and that's another great question. These things run in families. And when I read for people and they tell me that they've, had these experiences or they've been like this their whole life, often my next question is, what about your mother, your father, your grandparents? And they say, oh, yes, my grandmother was like this. So they run in families. They also, there's a strong strain among people who are creative, who are extroverted. There have been studies done about this. People who are creative, musicians, artists, writers, and who are extroverted tend to be more psychic or have more of these abilities. They're open. They're open, and allow these ideas and flow to come in. So, but your experience of seeing things when you were younger and being told that you had an overactive imagination. I mean, you were probably lucky compared to some people who are just told to stop that and never mention it again. So and then what happens is they shut down that ability, unless of course they were John Edwards, who said, I see someone in the corner, and she said, fantastic, let's call a medium. And so in his case, his abilities were developed from an early age and encouraged, but that's not usually the case.
And as we always say on this show, if your children are demonstrating any type of sensitivity, are open to subtle energy, then please encourage them, work with them. Don't turn them off, because you don't want to shut that down. That's a wonderful, wonderful gift, and just encourage it. So your story leads to your path in the world of finance, and then 2007, you end up in this psychic development class in New York. How did that happen for you?
I had been interested in taking an intuition or psychic development class, and it seemed like every time I saw the class come around, I had other plans. So it didn't happen until 2007. And now when I look back on it, I think that was very much by intent. I wasn't maybe supposed to take it until then. But I... went up to New York. I live on the East Coast, and I went up to New York for this weekend class. There were about 25 people in the class, men and women. I didn't know any of them. The teacher was not particularly woo-woo. She was a PhD from Columbia and a professor at Hunter College in Far Eastern Religion. So, told us that we did several exercises Saturday morning. And I was getting everything in these exercises, but they were very low-key exercises, so I was not particularly concerned about it. It wasn't until later in the class when we took a break, and we came back from the break, and the teacher said, now we're going to do a seance. And as you can imagine, I was a little bit alarmed by that. I wasn't there for a seance, and I didn't particularly want to do it. But I thought, well, you know, I'll just do this one exercise, and then we'll go on from there. So she told us she would put us in a meditative state and then take us out of the meditation, and if we saw anything, to let her know. And I thought, well, I'm not going to see anything. You know, that really doesn't pertain to me. And so she put us into a meditative state, and then she took us out of it. And then she said, does anyone see anything? And I looked around the room, and everyone was looking at each other. And I raised my hand, and she said, yes, Deborah, what do you see? And I said, I see about 50 people. These were people who had passed, and I was seeing relatives of mine who had passed. I was seeing people who had passed who went with the other students in the room, and then I was seeing just random people walking through the room who had passed. I saw some 42nd Street showgirls walking through the middle of the room, and I was completely overwhelmed.
Was this the first time you had an experience like that?
Yes, the first time.
Okay, we're going to continue the story in the next segment. My guest this week is Deborah Diamond. She's the author of Diary of a Death Doula, 25 Lessons the Dying Teach Us About the Afterlife. And we'll be back with more of Deborah after these words on the Om Times Radio Network.
Om Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization. Their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. Om Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
Hello, I'm Sandy Sedgbeer, host of Om Times Magazine's flagship radio show, What is Going On? My passion is sifting through information, research, and innovations from New Thought teachers, speakers, and researchers pushing back the boundaries of what we know about life, energy, metaphysics, and the universe. I love shifting perceptions about who we are, why we're here, and how quickly impossible becomes normal when we open our minds, expand our awareness, and accept that the only limits that exist are those we place upon ourselves. So if you're the kind of forward-thinking, eager investigator of what lies beyond the current reality that most perceive, why not make a date to come play with me in the field of possibilities at 4 p.m. Pacific Time, 7 p.m. Eastern Time every Thursday, and together we can discover what's really going on.
So I'm a cat, and I just moved in with this new human, and she's got this little toy she's always playing with all day long. Tap, 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 bloop, bloop. She can't put it down. There it is. Oh, and get this. She even talks to it. Last week, she asked it for Chinese. And guess what? Egg rolls showed up. Like magic. Humans have cool toys.
A person is the best thing to happen to a shelter pet. Be that person. Adopt. Brought to you by the Ad Council and the ShelterPetProject.org.
Looking for inspiration?
Want to be inspired?
Not sure where to go?
Find Mark and Kim every Wednesdays at 3 p.m. Eastern on Inspired Living.
Topics will elevate consciousness and range from metaphysics to the human and social experience and all things spiritual.
Welcome to an inspired community that offers support, encouragement, and new ways of thinking.
You are the inspired and the inspiration.
Thank you.
Back on Destination Unlimited, my guest this evening is Deborah Diamond. She's the author of Diary of a Death Doula, 25 Lessons the Dying Teach Us About the Afterlife. So you were talking about being in this intuitive or psychic development class in New York in 2007. You had this session, and then all of a sudden you started seeing all of these spiritual energies around the room. What happened?
Yeah, so I was completely overwhelmed. I was seeing, you know, people very vividly in the invisible realm. And the teacher said to me, you know, do you see anyone in the corner of the room? Because chances are if you see someone in the corner, they probably go with someone sitting in the corner. So I said, well, I do see someone in the corner. And the teacher asked me to describe him, and I did. He was he had black hair parted in the middle, a big handlebar mustache, and white teeth. And as I began to describe him, the woman sitting in that corner began to sob. And she said, I can take that person. And she said that was her fiance. She said he died 2 years ago. So the woman sitting in the corner said to me, if I show you a picture of him on my cell phone during the break, would you be able to identify him? And I said, sure, because he was just so vivid. And so during the break, she came over with her cell phone and she flipped through some pictures. And I said, there, that's him. And she said, yes, that's my fiance. He died 2 years ago. Now, she had wanted to hear from him, and she had not. She'd been waiting 2 years to hear from him. And so she was very appreciative for what I had done. And she thanked me and she hugged me. And, you know, I come from Wall Street, and there are no hugs on Wall Street and not a whole lot of thank yous either. So, you know, this was a completely new, you know, experience for me. But I did understand that I had done something profound for somebody, something meaningful. I mean, you know, the investment business is not full of these kinds of moments. So I was completely overwhelmed. But at the same time, I recognized that this was something special. I continued in that class the rest of the weekend, and I had more experiences. I had opened up something that was already there within me, but it opened up further. And people were coming up to me in the class and saying, geez, you must have been doing this for a long time. And I said, actually, I've never done this before. So I really didn't know, you know, what this was and, you know, what to do about it. I drove back home Sunday night, and I called my youngest son. I have three sons. The youngest one is very left brain, very logical. He scores real high on logic tests. So I called him and explained to him, you know, what happened. And he listened. And when I was all done, he said, he didn't say it didn't happen. He just said, well, we're just energy, and the energy has to go somewhere. And that explanation, you know, it made sense to me. It was sort of a combination of science and spirituality. He wasn't poo-pooing anything that happened. He didn't deny that it happened. He didn't say I was crazy or that I was seeing ghosts or, you know, anything like that. He just gave me an explanation that was based in science. And I could understand that. I could work with it. Now, I was still completely overwhelmed, and I didn't tell anybody what happened because people don't talk about these experiences. It's not the kind of thing that just comes up in normal conversation. People don't want to look crazy. They don't want to be embarrassed. They don't want their families to say, you know, it didn't happen. So I didn't mention it. A few months later, I went to Taos, New Mexico. I don't know if you've ever been there, Victor, but I had been there a number of times in the past, and I went out there that summer to paint. At least that's what I thought I was doing. And I rented a place for 2 months, and I went out there and I painted for 2 months. And when the 2 months were up and my lease was up, I said, well, I'm not going back. I didn't know why I wasn't going back, but I knew I wasn't going back. I just knew it. And so I stayed there. I rented another place and I stayed there, and I stayed for a number of years. And this is where I began to unpack the energy. And as a matter of fact, I'm thinking right now about an email I got from somebody I knew in the investment business at that time. And I said to him, you know, I came out to Taos, but I think I'm just going to stay out here and live here. And he wrote back and said, I could see staying there for a few days, but, you know, I not to live out there. That was the last communication I had. So anyway, I stayed out there, and that's when I began to unpack the energy. And I began to take classes and eventually did readings and did workshops. And out there in Taos, you know, when somebody asks you, what do you do? And you say, I'm a psychic, they say, oh, me too. You know, this is very normalized out there. You live in New York, I'm on the East Coast. You know, on the East Coast, it's very institutionalized. You know, you don't run into this so often. But in certain places, like on the West Coast and Taos and certain energetic centers, this, you know, nobody thinks anything about this. So this is where I began to relax and work with the energy because it was normalized. And I'm not sure I could have done that if I stayed on the East Coast. And now when I look back on it, I see that I was kind of led out there. And, you know, it's so important for all of us to pay attention to the messages that we get and kind of follow our, you know, follow these messages and follow our instincts. And when we get the feeling we should kind of go to the left or the right, you know, really honor that, because, you know, these messages come from spirit and they're the purest form of energy and the best information you can get. So, you know, if we can pay attention to them, it's for our greatest good and for, you know, really for the highest good, I think. So I stayed out there for a number of years, and eventually I came back east because I felt like my work was done and it was time to come back. And that's what I did. I came back and I thought, well, now that I'm back east, I'm not going to be doing this work anymore because, you know, the East Coast is not like Taos. But that's not what happened. I began to be approached by people who asked me to do readings, to teach workshops, and I eventually began, you know, doing this work on the East Coast. In 2013, I was asked to do a reading for a famous near-death experiencer, somebody who had an NDE and came back with these remarkable gifts following his NDE. And when I read for him, I read for him in Washington, D.C., and when I read for him, you know, I came back home that night and I thought, you know, what happened to him? Why does he have these gifts? And what about other NDEers? What do they get, if anything, and what are they supposed to do with it? And so I Googled near-death experience after effects and found out there had been very little research done. And I thought, well, I guess I'll have to do the research. Now, it's not that far-fetched because, remember, I was on Wall Street for many years. The first 10 years, I was a healthcare research analyst, so I knew how to do conventional research. So I did research on near-death experience after effects, people who came back with remarkable abilities and gifts, and there had not really been very much research done, so it was not part of the conversation at that point. It has since become a much larger part of the conversation, and my book is the only book, Life After Near Death, is the only book to examine the NDE through the through its miraculous after effects. So I, you know, I wrote that book, and now I have my new book, Diary of a Death Doula, is about my work as a death doula. And not everybody knows what a death doula is, but it's a fairly new concept. Many people have heard of birth doulas. They help usher in life, and death doulas help usher life out. Nobody knows how many death doulas there are, but it's probably in the thousands right now, but it is a field that's growing rapidly.
Now, we're actually going to touch on the death doula and the new book in the next segment, but I want to just spend a little time because I think the NDE situation, your research with NDE experiencers, actually led and helped you with the death doula work. So what I'd like to know is, what did you discover when you were interviewing people who experienced the NDEs? How did it change their lives?
Well, I decided to focus my work on people who return from NDEs with physiologic and cognitive after effects. And what do I mean by that? These were after effects that could be measured. People whose eyesight changed, that could be measured through physical exam. People whose hearing changed, same thing, that could be measured. People who had newfound mathematical abilities or artistic or musical abilities, these were easy to document, as opposed to people who come back and say, I'm more spiritual now. Well, you know, I believe them, but there's no way I can measure that. I can't measure how spiritual they were before their experience and how spiritual they were after their experience. So I wanted to focus on after effects that were demonstrable and recordable. And so that's what I did in the book. But, you know, the research on near-death experiences up until that point, and still it's still pretty much this way, has consisted of giving people a form to fill out and boxes to check. And that's fine for the scientific world, but the problem is NDEs don't take place in that world. They take place in consciousness, and science can't even define what consciousness is, and they can't measure it. So these experiencers had many questions themselves about what happened to them in their experiences, and they were questions that couldn't be answered by checking off a box. So my work and what I did as an author writing Life After Near Death was to not only do the pick and shovel work of interviewing them and giving them questions to answer, but I also did readings on everyone. And because I'm a medium and a psychic, and I could. So I asked everyone if they would like a reading, and 100% of them wanted the readings because they also had questions about what happened. They had questions like, why didn't I have a life review? Or who were the beings of light that I met? You know, those are not things you can answer with a questionnaire. So I did readings, and what happened in the readings was I went with them on their NDEs. I didn't know what to expect. I'd never done that before. But what did happen was I experienced their NDEs as they experienced them. And there were certain patterns that existed that we found.
And we're going to talk about those patterns in the next segment. My guest this week on Destination Unlimited, Deborah Diamond. She's the author of Diary of a Death Doula, 25 Lessons the Dying Teach Us About the Afterlife. Deborah, for our listeners, please tell them where they can get your book and find out more about you and this amazing work.
Thank you, Victor. So, Life After Near Death, Miraculous Stories of Healing and Transformation in the Extraordinary Lives of People with Newfound Powers is available on Amazon. The audiobook just came out, so you can buy it by, you know, with an audiobook, a hardbound, or on Kindle. It's also available in bookstores, and you can also order it on my website, DeborahDiamondPsychic.com. People can also get in touch with me through my website, DeborahDiamondPsychic.com, for readings and for consultations. And I also, of course, give talks and workshops.
And we'll be back with more of Deborah after these words on the Om Times Radio Network.
This is OTRFM, part of the iOM Radio Network.
Humanity Healing International is a small nonprofit with a big dream. Since 2007, HHI has been working tirelessly to bring help to communities with little or no hope. Our projects are not broad mandates, nor are they overnight solutions, but they bring the reassurance that no one is alone and that someone cares. To learn more, please visit humanityhealing.org. Humanity Healing is where your heart is.
Tune in to The Practical Intuitive, Mind, Body, Spirit for the Real World, with me, host Robin Fritz, Mondays at 2 p.m. Pacific, 5 Eastern. I'll cover personal and business intuition, animal communication, mediumship, space clearing, past life regression, shamanic insights, energy healing, soul choice, and more, all to help you tap your own intuitive and healing skills. No ifs, ands, or buts.
Wake up and text. Text and eat. Mm-mm. Text and catch the bus. Text and miss your stop.
Wait.
Text and be late to work.
Sorry, I'm late.
Text and work. Text and pretend to work. Text and act surprised when someone calls you out for not working.
Who, me?
Text and meet up with a friend you haven't seen in forever.
Hi.
Oh, hey.
Text and complain that they're on their phone the whole time. Text and listen to them complain that you're on your phone the whole time.
Ugh.
Text and whatever. But when you get behind the wheel, give your phone to a passenger. Put it in the glove box. Just don't text and drive. Visit StopTextsStopWrecks.org. A public service announcement brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
Back on Destination Unlimited, my guest this week is Deborah Diamond. She's the author of Diary of a Death Doula, 25 Lessons the Dying Teach Us About the Afterlife. So, Deborah, in the previous segment, we were talking about your working with NDE experiencers and actually working with them on a psychic medium level to experience the NDE with them. What did you find?
Okay, sure. So what we found is that there were certain patterns that existed with these experiencers. And one of the patterns was that many of their lives were referenced by darkness for, you know, in many cases for an extended period of time. It could have been that they had abuse in their childhood. They could have gone through periods of, lots of, just very difficult periods in their life. Now, you know, I know I was on another program and I said something about this and somebody wrote in or called in and said, you know, everybody has this. Yeah, sure. I not to minimize it or to dramatize it. Everybody does go through ups and downs in lives. But what I found was, number one, most of these people, or many of these people, had abusive childhoods. And number two, their entire lives were referenced by darkness, or always feeling like they didn't fit in. And so that was a pattern that became evident. And we also found that many of them also felt that there was something else out there. You know, they just felt there was something more out there. And in some cases, wish to be shown it, you know, or somehow set their intention to be shown something else. Now, this does not mean that you can bring on an NDE. I see that there are classes offered and workshops offered now on how to have an NDE. You cannot teach a class on how to have an NDE. This is something that is outside of man's control. But my belief was, after interviewing and reading for these people, was that this is something that the universe directs. And what do I mean by that? Well, again, it seemed like people's lives went on for a very long time, referenced by darkness. And then they'd have their NDEs, and everything would be flipped upside down. Their lives would literally be turned upside down. But one thing that was uniform was that they all came back feeling as if they had a mission. They didn't know what the missions were in some cases, but they all used the word mission. That, you know, they all would say, "What's my mission?" And they were, in effect, missionaries for the light. And who would be a better missionary than someone whose life was referenced by darkness? I mean, they, you know, they would be very ready to embrace the light. So, you know, that was something that was universal in these cases. And as I've read for NDEers and STEers over the years, I found this to be true with others as well. And I've read for thousands of people and talked to thousands of NDEers. So I feel like this is something where the universe lets people go on for some period of time until they're ripe, until they're ready, and then the universe intercedes. You know, that's, I know it may sound kind of crazy, you know, but it seems almost like the universe watches these people and, you know, wants them to be recruits at the right time. And the way to make them a recruit is, you know, for them to have this experience, and then, you know, they're ready to be the missionary. So that was something that was, I think, the most profound finding out of the readings and the research. You know, I felt before I started the research was there was much more to the NDE than the tunnel and the light. You know, up until that time, all the information about NDEs was anecdotal. It was about people telling their stories. And it still is for the most part. You know, I went through a tunnel, I saw the light, I came back. And people are titillated by that. And of course, it lends itself very much to the media, to television and movies. You know, there's a lot you can do with the light and with the tunnel and things like that. But I felt like there was much more to this experience, much more meaning to it than just, you know, what happens to them in the NDE. The NDE itself can last seconds or minutes of Earth time, but the after effects last a lifetime. And I felt like there had to be some more meaning in that. There was a reason that they were having these NDEs, and why were they having them, and what was the meaning of what they were left with. So that was, you know, that was really the genesis of the idea for the book. And then, of course, the research in the book and all the readings kind of help to provide an answer for that.
So here you have your psychic reawakening, being able to see spirit, do readings for people, work with people, heal people. You do your research. You have your trip to Taos. You come back, you do your research on the NDEs. What drew you into working with those who were in the process of transition?
Yeah, well, so my mother passed away in 2001. Up until then, I'd never been with anyone who was dying. And I think that's very common. I think very few people today have ever been around death, you know, or experienced somebody's death or been with sat with a dying person. My idea up until then of death was something like what you might see in the movies or television. You know, it would be very dramatic and sudden, and a thunderbolt would come out of the universe. That's not at all what real physical death is like, but that's what I thought it was like. When my mom was dying, we had hospice come to help us and to help her. And they were wonderful. And at one point, the hospice professional handed me a piece of paper. And she said, "You might want to read this." Well, I thought it might have something to do with medications or maybe even funeral arrangements. And I set it aside. But at one point, I picked it up and I read it. And it said, "If the body's ready and the soul isn't, you don't leave. And if the soul is ready and the body isn't, you don't leave. When the body's ready and the soul is ready, then you leave." And I thought, you know, here's this hospice professional telling me that death is really a process involving body and soul. And I hadn't really considered that. So that really stuck with me. And as a matter of fact, it stuck with me for about 15 years. So I knew I wanted to be a service. I knew I wanted to do something in hospice. I just didn't know exactly what it was. But I thought about it. I kept thinking about it, and I knew I would do something. Eventually, I trained to be a death doula. Death doulas sit bedside. In my program, they sit bedside with the actively dying, and I knew that was something that I could do because as a medium, I talk to people who are dead, so, you know, all the time. So I knew that that wouldn't bother me. And so that's, you know, that's the genesis of how I began to do this work.
Now, how do you incorporate your psychic gifts and NDE studies with the doula work?
Well, I am, you know, I am really a doula. I don't go in there as a psychic or an NDEer. I mean, I'm at service as a doula, and my work is to be the eyes and ears of the medical staff and the families. I mean, for families, they don't want their loved ones to die alone, and many people are afraid to come to hospice to be with their loved one. They'd rather remember mom as she was. And, you know, most people in our culture have a tremendous fear of death. So many of these patients are by themselves, but the families do not want their loved ones to be by themselves. So one of the services that doulas perform is to, you know, sit bedside with the loved one. Now, I am a medium, and not all death doulas are mediums, but because I am, I'm able to see the invisible world at end of life. That's just something that I can see. So when I'm sitting bedside, I often have experiences where I'm able to see, you know, beyond the veil, see the patient journeying at end of life, see their loved ones in spirit coming into the room, see the kind of celestial encounters that they're having. And at times the patients will communicate with me, you know, telepathically. So I found that there were many similarities between near-death experiences and actual physical death. There are similarities up to a point. Physical terminal death is obviously much more involved, and the experience in the invisible side is more involved, and I'm happy to talk more about that.
Now, does one's faith have a bearing on how they leave this world?
I'm sorry, one's what?
One's faith, one's religion have a bearing on the way they leave this world.
Yeah, so, you know, it's sort of like, I mean, this is true in the NDE realm and also with actual physical death. If people are very religious, you know, if they expect to see Buddha or Jesus, they're going to, chances are they're going to see them in their near-death experience, and the same can be true at end of life when you're going through actual physical death. You may have an experience, if you're very religious, for instance, you may journey to a magnificent cathedral, you know, and nothing like what we would ever experience on earth, but you may have a vision of a magnificent cathedral with a choir of angelic voices. You know, that might be your experience. If you're not a person of faith, you may not have that experience. You may have a different kind of experience. And that's very similar to what happens with the NDE. These experiences that we have in our consciousness are very customized to us. And I don't know how that happens. It's a mystery, but it does happen. So, you know, we know that in an NDE that the visions that people have are visions that are meaningful to them, that the conversations and experiences that they have are significant to them. And the same thing is true at end of life, you know, with the actively dying. They're having journeys and transitions that are unique to them. They may be revisiting places in their memories that they're very fond of. They may be seeing people, loved ones that are meaningful to them. They may be having an experience, as you mentioned, a faith-based experience. So, you know, it's a mystery, you know, how that takes place, but it does.
When we transition, do we retain our senses?
Yes, we actually do, I believe. You know, we were told in hospice training that the hearing is the last sense to go. So it's very important for friends and loved ones when they come to visit their loved one who's actively dying to be sensitive about that. This is not the time to be having an argument in the room. This is not the time to assume, well, the person's probably, they're almost dead, so we could start making funeral arrangements in front of them. They hear you. They hear everything, and they register not only in their hearing, but I believe in other senses. They know when people are in the room. They're very cognizant. So, yes, your senses are still with you. You know, for those who are visiting a loved one in hospice or in the hospital, you know, you walk into a room, you see this body in bed, and it looks as if no one's home, but there's a lot more going on than what we can see in the visible world.
My guest is Deborah Diamond. She's the author of Diary of a Death Doula, 25 Lessons the Dying Teach Us About the Afterlife. We'll be back with more of Deborah after these words on the OM Times Radio Network.
Ascending Hearts is no ordinary dating site, but a spiritual dating site with a purpose, to link you with your soulmate. We engineer the serendipity so you can trust that you will attune with someone that has the same matching vibration as you. Ascending Hearts, the conscious dating site for the spiritually aware. Try Ascending Hearts for free, ascendinghearts.com.
Change and growth are part of natural life, and also part of your spiritual life. Everyone needs support and guidance, especially during life passages. Upgrade yourself with the OM Times Experts program. With OM Times Experts, you have access to the best intuitive coaches, spiritual teachers, counselors, astrologists, and oracles. Our team was carefully selected so you can trust. Find out more at experts.omtimes.com.
Adopt US Kids presents What to Expect When You're Expecting a Teenager. Learning the lingo.
Jelly. Jelly adjective. Jelly is a shorter, better way to say jealous. As in, Chloe, I am like so jelly of your unicorn phone case.
You don't have to speak teen to be a perfect parent. Thousands of teens in foster care will love you just the same. Visit AdoptUSKids.org. Brought to you by the US Department of Health and Human Services, AdoptUSKids, and the Ad Council.
Hi, this is Bill Maher. I can find humor in almost anything, but one thing I never laugh about is cruelty to animals. If you don't get the joke either, write People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, 501 Front Street, Norfolk, Virginia, 23510.
So, you know, I'm a dog, and I'm kind of new to this family, but I've noticed a trend. My humans do this thing where they go around and get all my toys and hide them in this basket, but it's always the same basket, and it's always the same place. And then they act so surprised when I find them. But I'm like, hello, that's where you put it last time. Humans are the worst at hide-and-go-seek.
A person is the best thing to happen to a shelter pet. Be that person. Adopt. Brought to you by the Ad Council and the ShelterPetProject.org.
back on Destination Unlimited. My guest this week is Deborah Diamond. She's the author of Diary of a Death Doula, 25 Lessons the Dying Teach Us About the Afterlife. What happens to the soul, Deborah, when we leave the body?
So at end of life, people journey as they transition. They leave their bodies, and they are, you know, it's very much like a near-death experience where they can look down on their bodies and, you know, are disassociated from it. But they are journeying, and they may journey to, as I mentioned earlier, they may journey to familiar realms. They may visit their new home. They may see loved ones in spirit. And it's generally a joyful and a peaceful experience from what I've seen. As they journey, this is unscientific, but it's, you know, based on what I've seen and the work that I've done. So let's assume that we are something like 98% physical body and 2% consciousness as we walk around here on Earth. When we have a near-death experience or a spiritually transformative experience, we come back with our energy altered. Now we have a little more consciousness. And let's say now we're, you know, 95% physical body and 5% consciousness. Our consciousness has been enhanced. It's increased. That's what makes it difficult for many NDEers to navigate the Earth, because we're not really built to, you know, have that titration. Same thing happens at end of life. You know, people journey, but it's not like a near-death experience where they're out of body once. They're out of body multiple times. And every time they're out of body, they come back a little different. Their consciousness has been expanded. And that happens at the same time that their physical body is declining. So, you know, the ratio, I believe, continues to shift, you know, in favor of consciousness as your physical body declines. Now, I had dinner a few weeks ago with a friend of mine who's a hospice chaplain in New Mexico, and she said, "Tell me about your book in a couple sentences." And I said, "Well, number one, there's much more going on in the invisible world than we recognize. And number two, we continue to exist." And then I talked to her about how our consciousness expands. And she said, "You know, that makes sense. I see my patients, and they journey, and they're out of body. And every time they come back, they're a little bit different." So that's, you know, that's what happens. And, you know, that's an evolution that takes place over some period of time until, you know, until they actively pass, until they die, at which point they're total consciousness. So that's gets back to that idea of a process, you know, the body and the soul. You know, there are two things going on. It's just not the death of the physical body. I think here on Earth, we tend to think of birth and death as a physical experience. You know, when you're born and there's, you know, a baby emerges, we, you know, we call that life. And we look at that physical body and we say, that's life. And the same thing at end of life, you know, when the physical body deteriorates, we say, that's death. But, you know, actually, there's both the physical body and the consciousness that are present, both at the beginning of life and end of life.
What realizations do we have when we start the process of transitioning?
Well, we're out of body. I mean, someone, I was on another show, and someone asked me, they said, when we're out of body, does that mean that we're up there floating around thinking, oh, I'm dying, or, you know, or I'm dead? And that's not really been the experience that I've witnessed. People are not thinking in those terms. They're completely out of body, and they're thinking that they're comfortable, that they feel peaceful, that it's remarkable, that it feels joyful, that they've never had an experience like this. And, you know, and it's ineffable. That's a word that's thrown around a lot in the NDE world. It can't be described. So they're not, you know, necessarily focused on their physical bodies. We might be focused on their physical bodies, but they are not. They are leaving their physical bodies behind. They're in transition. So you know, it's an experience unlike anything else that we have on Earth, except, you know, maybe a near-death experience. And near-death experiences are different because it's, you know, again, it's just one experience, and it's sort of like the previews to the movies, you know, it's just like the highlights, because NDEs are meant to be teaching experiences, whereas actual physical death is, you know, is a transition, a permanent transition. So, you know, but when people die and they transition, they're still them. I mean, you know, our essence still continues to exist. They're still there. Their physical body, you know, the suit that they wore on Earth is of no use anymore, but, you know, their essence continues to exist. And that's why, as a medium, I can continue to talk to people who are on the other side, and they come in readings just as they did in real life. You know, their personalities are intact, their, you know, their relationships are intact, all of that.
Do you encourage family members to express their love to those who are in the process of transition?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a great thing to do. You know, this is not the time to try to work out family conflicts, especially bedside and hospice. This is a time for peace. And, you know, of course, if you've already, you know, you don't have to wait until someone dies or is nearly dying to express your love. But if you want to, when that person is at end of life, I think that helps to promote a good death. I think having good family relations helps to promote a good death. I mean, one thing that we do see at hospice, and I'm sure you've talked to family and friends who've experienced this, you know, it's a time of high, you know, emotions run high, and anxiety and conflict often in families. So, you know, anything you can do to minimize that and to promote love and to tell your loved one that they are loved and cherished, I think is, you know, that's a high vibration. Love is a high vibration. So I think that's a wonderful thing to do.
Do we encounter angels or guides at the time we're leaving our body?
Yeah, I see angels and guides when I do readings with people, and I also see them at times with people that I sit bedside with. Angels, I've seen them come in to do their celestial work and hover over patients and sort of do this very light and loving work to help a patient and instill higher energies in their aura, you know, to sort of grease the wheels and make the journey easy and pleasant and light. And the same thing with guides. I mean, you know, there's a whole panoply of support people, both, you know, loved ones who've passed or on the other side and others who we've never met, who become activated at end of life. I mean, they're with us, they're with all of us here on Earth, but many people don't recognize that and don't ever activate them. But they, you know, can become very active at end of life, and I have, you know, seen them. I've experienced them from time to time. We get a lot of assistance from the other side at end of life. You know, I have seen families in spirit in all the rooms of patients that I've sat with. They all come in, and they just kind of stand there. They don't impose themselves on the patient, but they are there to provide comfort and support, and the patient knows that and appreciates it.
What lessons have you personally learned as a death doula?
You know, I think the most important lesson is that we continue to exist. And, you know, again, as I said earlier, there's much more that goes on than just, you know, we have to, I think it's important to look at life as not just life here on this material plane, but that life exists in another dimension, in an invisible dimension. Now, more and more people are coming into this idea that there's more that goes on than what we could see, but it's particularly noticeable and prevalent at end of life. And I think that it would alleviate some of the fears of death that we have in our culture if we thought there was more to death and, you know, more to life than just, you know, that when we are physically gone, that that's the end of us. There's a lot of fear around death in our culture. And part of that is because, you know, 100 years ago, 150 years ago, death was part of life. People died at home, surrounded by their loved ones. That doesn't happen as much anymore because loved ones can be spread out. They could be all over the country, and patients can end up in a hospital or other clinical setting where it's, you know, kind of scary. And in the medical world, the idea that there's an invisible dimension is not, you know, their number one idea. Their idea is that death is a failure, so they do whatever they can to keep life going. But I think if the idea that there's more to what happens to us at end of life than what we recognize with the visible eye, I think that that would provide solace and comfort and a different way of looking at death and open up the conversation about end of life and death.
What would you like readers to take away from Diary of a Death Doula?
I'd like them to have a conversation about death. People are afraid to talk about death. There's a stigma around it. There's a taboo around it. And I think anything that we can do to get those conversations going is a huge positive and something that can help all of us. So, you know, my number one request would be to, you know, read the book, think about it, and then talk to your loved ones about it. You know, the conversation starts now. You don't have to wait. So that would be what I would recommend.
That's sage advice. My guest, Deborah Diamond, she's the author of Diary of a Death Doula, 25 Lessons the Dying Teach Us About the Afterlife. Deborah, please, one more time, tell our listeners where they can find your book and find out more about you.
They can find my book on Amazon, IndieBound, and BarnesandNoble.com, and also on my website, DeborahDiamondPsychic.com. And I also want to say that the book is coming out October 25th, and once the book comes out, when you read it, if you will leave a review on Amazon, take a screenshot of the review, and email me your screenshot at diamond.deborah@gmail.com, we're going to do an online book club with the author. It's free. There's no charge, and it'll be an exclusive book club with the author. So it'll be a lot of fun, and we'll have community around it, and we'll get the conversation going about death and dying.
Deborah, thank you so much for joining us, sharing your experience as a death doula, and also your amazing life. Your story is truly a wonderful story, and I think it's an inspiration to others that if you have a calling, follow that calling.
Thank you, Victor. It's a pleasure.
And thank you for joining us on Destination Unlimited. I'm Victor the Voice Furman. Have a wonderful week.